for BBC Radio 3. Thanks to my producer, Alex Anderson, and our studio manager in London's broadcasting house, Callum Lawrence.
How do you like your breakfast? Here on Radio 3, we offer ours sunny side up, with melodies you know and love, pieces you'll be delighted to discover, and some joyous surprises. As we contemplate the year ahead and set new habits, start each day the best way. Breakfast with me, Petroc Trelawney, every weekday morning from 6:30 on Radio 3 and BBC Sounds.
It's just after midday and time for Private Passions, and Michael Barclay's guest is the American actor and film director Todd Field.
My guest today, Todd Field, started out as a jazz musician and as an actor in over 40 films, including Kubrick's Eyes Wide Shut and Woody Allen's Radio Days. He then went on to direct two full-length award-winning films, In the Bedroom, about grief and revenge in a close-knit family, and Little Children, starring Kate Winslet. Both were nominated for multiple Oscars. This week, his third feature film, Tar, opens in Britain. Kate Blanchett stars as Lydia Tarr, the conductor of a major German orchestra. The film's an exploration of the darker side of the classical music world, the power of the conductor, but it's also a celebration of some really wonderful music. I saw it last night, Todd, and without giving too much of the plot away, I found it deeply provocative. It's the kind of film you want to see with friends and have a good argument about. Is that perhaps what you wanted?
Yes.
Well, you can argue with me today. You wrote the screenplay as well as directing, and it's a very subtle script. Our focus here today is, of course, music, and the music in Tar is woven through, as it is with your other films. You've sent us a playlist which includes Mahler, Goretzky, Elgar, jazz. And I thought we really ought to start with Mahler's Fifth, because it's at the heart of the new film, isn't it?
Indeed it is. The Fifth has always loomed large in my world, like for many. And I think, like for many people, the first time I heard it, I thought it was that I had personally discovered it. I felt very attached to it and very proprietary about it. Then saw the Visconti film. And,
Death in Venice.
Indeed. And I think I felt so embarrassed, you know, like, well, everybody knows it. And
the Adagietto in particular, which is what we're going to hear, what you've chosen.
Yes. And when he first conducted it, it was only 7 minutes long. I think that's what's interesting about this version of it with Claudio Abbado with the Berlin Philharmonic, which is it's very melancholic when it's slower, it's tragic when it's slower, and when it's faster, it has this kind of gigantic sense of possibility for romance, you know.
Thank you.
It really hits one. Claudio Abbado conducting the Berlin Philharmonic in the fourth movement of Mahler's Fifth Symphony. Music which is the centrepiece of your new film about a classical conductor, Lydia Tár. Not a real historical figure, but one that certainly rings true in so many ways. And I wonder how much research you did talking to conductors, members of orchestras.
Well, the first person I spoke to, and this was at the very beginning of the very first lockdown that we all experienced in March 2020, was John Mauchery. John Mauchery had been Leonard Bernstein's assistant, was the only person while Leonard Bernstein was alive who was allowed to conduct Bernstein's compositions. And he was an incredible educator. He's also written three very, very fine books about the art of conducting. So that was an incredible start, you know, and John was very generous with his time and pointed me in a lot of directions that I continued on throughout the script writing. Once I could actually get out of my barn, you know, and we were allowed to sort of move more freely out of hazmat suits, I did interview players. And some of the players I interviewed, specifically with the Dresden Philharmonie, which is the orchestra of record in the film, I sat one day and probably talked to 40 of different players. And I spoke to them about what it was like coming up for them. In this case, specifically the female players. And I would ask them the same question. Do you feel that your experience coming up, that you faced any challenges that your male counterparts didn't? And of course they said, yes, absolutely. And one of those players was a viola player. And she said, I'll give you an example. And she wasn't very old, you know, I mean, she was maybe 40. She said, when I first came up, I was the first viola chair player in the entire history of the Munich Orchestra. Now, this is 2022, you know, so yeah, there was a very rich education in terms of the people that we all spoke with in terms of preparing for the film.
It's very much about power. The relationships in the film are what you might call transactional. People in the musical world are all using each other to get on. So who does hold the real power? The conductor has to audition and sack people. How much do you feel you're showing a world which is rather ugly and nepotistic? I wonder whether you came to think differently about the music world after making this film.
I don't know about nepotistic. I mean, I think there are rules inside hermetic institutions that are outside of life. I mean, let's say we put the story in academia. There are rules in academia. Academia is outside of life. Classical music is outside of life. It informs life as academia does, but it is its own planet with its own gravity, its own set of rules. So there are traditions, and whether those traditions are healthy or sound or simply traditions is a very big conversation. And it's a big conversation amongst people within classical music right now.
Mm. We're going to hear David Bowie next, but not singing, because he is narrating, isn't he, Peter and the Wolf?
Yes, and David Bowie narrated Peter and the Wolf in the mid-70s during his Berlin period, and it's not a period of the great David Bowie's life that you would associate with Prokofiev.
And how do you think he does it? What does he bring to it?
Oh, I mean, you know, the thing about Bowie is he always had the pixie in him, you know. That's not something that you can pretend to have. You just have it. And you feel that sense of wit and that sense of joy in that narration that's just lovely.
This is the story of Peter and the Wolf. Each character in this tale is going to be represented by a different instrument of the orchestra. For instance, the bird will be played by the flute, like this. Here's the duck, played by the oboe. The cat, by the clarinet. Thank you. The bassoon will represent grandfather. The Wolf by the French Horns. And Peter by the Strings. Blast of the hunter's shotguns, played by the kettle drums.
You know, so this was the first piece of music that I had been exposed to when I was 6 years old. I had a music teacher named Mr. Wick, and Mr. Wick at the elementary school used to come over and grab me by the ears and lift me off the ground and say, "Good morning, Todd," which was very painful. But he was a wonderful teacher, and he was kind of a heroic figure for me because it was the 70s, and he had this kind of wild hair, and he drove a Karmann Ghia with a vanity license plate that said "Listen" on it.
That's the introduction to Peter and the Wolf by Prokofiev, a recording from 1978 with Eugene Ormandy and the Philadelphia Orchestra, with narration by David Bowie. I said at the beginning, Todd Field, that you started out as a musician. As a teenager, you played trombone in a big band and got a music scholarship to college. This was in Oregon, where you were brought up. So what kind of childhood was it, apart from being lifted up by the ears?
Oh, it was an incredible childhood. It's what you would call today, you know, free-range childhood, which is we lived in a fairly rural area surrounded by woods, and we were allowed to do anything that we wanted to do, anything. And the only rule was around dusk we should probably start to listen, and that we would hear a piercing whistle from my father. And if we weren't home within 5 minutes of that piercing whistle, we were in real trouble. But other than that, we were kind of free to do whatever we wanted to do, and that created all kinds of opportunities and a very rich interior life that I'm really grateful for having. Mm.
One of the most surprising aspects of your early life, researching your biography, is the connection with bubblegum, because a very successful brand of American bubblegum was actually created in your kitchen at home.
We did make bubblegum in our home out of a send-away package in my mother's kitchen. My mother, by the way, her name is Candy, to make it even better. And Wrigley bought it, and the rest is history. I can't throw a stone and not see a pouch of Big League Chew around.
Big League Chew, yes, that's what it became. But you didn't actually make your fortune out of bubblegum.
No, blessedly I didn't. Had I had access to that kind of money, I think it would have ruined me. I wouldn't be sitting here with you today.
Yeah. You know? One of the earliest ways that you did earn a living was an introduction to cinema, because you were a projectionist for a while, weren't you?
I was indeed, yeah. I was a projectionist at the Village Theater, which was an old theater, a strange combination of Hollywood mainstream at that time and foreign films. And I ran six projectors a day, and I reckon probably much of how I engage with film comes out of that period of time for sure.
You want to hear Sarah Vaughan next, singing Polka Dots and Moonbeams, a popular song from the 1940s. But you met Sarah Vaughan, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I met Sarah Vaughan in the most magical way you could want to meet someone. When I was playing jazz, a friend of mine, Mitch, called me up from Eugene, Oregon, which is quite a scamper from Portland. It's a drive. And said, "I've got tickets. Count Basie's coming." Now, I'd played every Count Basie chart there was. I was just obsessed with Basie. So I leapt at the chance, but I had this old 1968 three-speed automatic Volkswagen. They only made it for 1 year for good reason. And the cable on the accelerator was broken. So I had to rig it to my tennis shoes. And then I had to pull my foot up on the freeway instead of pushing it down to keep it going. And it was raining on top of that. And the windshield wipers were broken. And so I was like trying to get there alive. And I arrive at this auditorium dripping wet, like a drowned rat. And there's Mitch. And he's with this very comely young woman. And I said, okay, we're going to go to the concert. He said, oh, no, I'm taking Gretchen. I said, I just drove 2 hours. No, you have to let me come in. And he said, no, I'm sorry. And he was very practical about it. And there was a line at the window. So I went in and I finally got to the front and I said, I've got to get in here. She said, I'm sorry, son, it's sold out. I said, no, you don't understand. I've got to see him. I've got to see him. And she said, would it be all right if you listened to the concert from backstage? And I said, yeah, that'll be all right. And I stood in the wings and I watched that whole concert and I met Sarah Vaughan. She would hit the high note, she would come off, and she had her assistant standing there, you know, with a low ball of whiskey and a lit Marlboro Red cigarette. She would drink it, she'd suck it down, half the cigarette in a single go, let it go, and then go back center stage and then hit the encore again, you know. it was incredible.
Well, let's hear Polka Dots and Moonbeams.
It's just extraordinary.
Country dance was being held in a garden. I felt a bump. Oops. And then an old beg your pardon. Suddenly I saw polka dots and moonbeams all around. A pug-nosed dream, the music started. And was I the perplexed one? I held my breath and said, may I have the next one in my frightened arms, polka dots and moonbeams sparkled on a pug-nosed dream. There were questions in the eyes of the dancers as we floated over the floor. A few things more. No, in a cottage built of lilacs and laughter, I know the meaning of the words. And moonbeams, oh, when I kissed that pug-nosed dream. that pug knows.
Sarah Vaughan with Polka Dots and Moonbeams by Jimmy Van Huysen and Johnny Burke from her 1963 album Sassy Swings the Tivoli, a song about living happy ever after in a cottage built of lilacs and laughter. Well, talking of that, you yourself live in Maine, Todd, don't you, in a house on the coast with your wife Serena Rathbun and four children. And I believe it was your wife who really encouraged you to become a director. You'd left your music studies, become a successful actor, working for notable directors. But how did you make the transition to becoming a director yourself, and how did she help?
But Serena sat me down and said, you need to do this. And I said, well, but how are we going to do this? You know, we had a one child at that point. And she said, well, I'll figure out a way to make it work. So she went out and bought a pickup truck, and she started going to flea markets, and she put together a shop. And within about 6 months, she became one of the top interior designers in the country. And she put me through film school.
Your first full-length film as a director was released in 2001. This was In the Bedroom, starring Tom Wilkinson and Sissy Spacek. It won 5 Oscar nominations. But is it true that you took on Harvey Weinstein over the film? He wanted you to cut certain scenes, and I think you refused.
Yes. I mean, we made it for very little money. Harvey wasn't at Sundance that year, Sundance Film Festival, and he hated the film, and he was upset with the people at Miramax who bought it.
Miramax being Harvey Weinstein's film company.
Indeed it is. So when I got the phone call that they'd sold it to Miramax, I was physically very ill. And my wife kept saying, you know, from the other side of the door, you all right in there? You know, and once I wiped my face and came out of the bathroom, Serena said, what are you going to do? And I said, well, she said, you need to call someone who knows Harvey. Now, Tom Cruise is why I wrote In the Bedroom. He sort of demanded that I was going to direct a film and challenged me in terms of answering him what that film was going to be. And I wrote the script while we were making Eyes Wide Shut together. So I rang Tom up and I said, I bet you know Harvey Weinstein. And he said, yes. And I said, he just bought my film. And he said, uh-oh. I said, what do I do? He said, show me the film. So I showed it to him, and he came out, and he grabbed me, and he locked me in a room for an entire evening and said, okay, this is what you're going to do to protect it, and you have to protect this film. Don't let him kill it. Now, the first thing that Tom told me very wisely, he said, it's going to take a few months. But he said, go to him and say, you know, master, what are your ideas? And whatever he says, do it, but you be the executioner of your own creation and then test it. And it's going to go really badly. And then go back to him and say, let's do more. Let's do more. Let's do more until soon there are no arms or legs or head on that creature. And never doubt what he says, or at least pretend not to doubt it. And I was told at the time by the people that test films that we had achieved this magnificent number, which was the lowest test score in the history of their organization. And Tom said, when you get to that point, you've got all these reviews from Sundance, you already have all these supporters, pull them out of your briefcase and put them in front of Harvey and say, I don't know, maybe we should go back and test the version of the film that you purchased. And once that happens, you'll have beat him. And of course, that's what happened.
Why were you worried that Harvey Weinstein had bought the film?
Well, I don't know if you know over here, but in America, Harvey was known simply as Harvey Scissorhands. And for years afterwards, I would get calls from other filmmakers, and they would ask me, they would say, how did you do it? How do you beat him? And I would tell them what it took. And they'd say, I don't have 6 months to do that. I can't keep the lights on. I said, I couldn't either. But you have to, that's what you're going to have to do.
He really was a rather pernicious character in so many ways.
Well, I think he was a frustrated filmmaker. He wanted to be a filmmaker.
Mm. Music next by Henryk Gorecki, his second string quartet from 1991. This music was very much in your head during the making of Tár, wasn't it?
Well, it was in my head when I was writing the script. There were several pieces of music that I listened to working every day. This was the one that I listened to mostly. And when I sent the script to Hildur Gundadottir, who's the composer for Tár, she said, "What were you listening to when you were writing the script?" And I said, "Oh, okay, I'll send you some of it." And I sent her several pieces, and she said, "What were you listening to mostly?" And I said, "It was the Gorecki." And she said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, it's a wicked piece of music. It's so relentless and so determined, and that's how I feel about this character, that there's this inner propulsion in her. It's almost like she's been cursed with this inner propulsion that she can't stop. It's sort of like, you know, the plagues where people dance themselves to death. So I wanted her to feel like she's marching all the time, like a Tár march." And she said, "All right, well, I love this music, and it's 120 beats per minute." And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "Well, then that's her gait. That's how she walks." And then when I got to Berlin, we sat down and she tempo-mapped all the characters with me. And then she composed music at these different tempos with the London Contemporary Orchestra and Robert Ames and a small string quartet in Berlin that summer before we started shooting. And then that music was then played both for Kate in her ear when she was walking. She's always walking 120 beats per minute.
Bum, 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 bum. Bum, 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 bum.
And that was a really smart thing for her to see, and it really opened up the conversation for the film, because even though you don't hear this music, it's there. You feel the pulse, you know.
Well, let's hear the Gorecki to which she timed her perambulation, if you like.
Yes.
With lots of silences, stopping, starting, used as dramatic moments. Thank you.
It's such a wicked piece of music, isn't it?
Yeah, especially as played by the Kronos Quartet there, the second movement of the String Quartet No. 2, Quasi una Fantasia by Henryk Gorecki.
And words are poor things when you're talking about music.
Well, that's the challenge of this program,
yes.
Todd. But actually, it's in a way that refusal to allow you, the listener, to relax, because there's always some disconcerting small shock on its way.
And it's very small things in this piece of music where it's so relentless. It's so unrelenting, you know. And then there's a rise on a high line. Boop, 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 boop. You know, and it feels monumental. You're like, oh, it changed, you know.
And in a way, you know, that technique taken over a larger canvas reminds me of your work. In The Bedroom and Little Children, the first two feature films, setting is American suburbia. You tackle really dark topics, murder, child abuse, and create a sense of menace. Well, gradually, we don't know at first, but gradually build up a menace so that we know that there is violence just under the surface. Is that something that you aspire to?
Yeah. I don't know. I think it's always strange. I'm so interested to talk to people or to hear people talk about things I've been involved with, their interpretations fascinate me. I feel like I'm getting free psychiatry, you know. But I don't, it's not something on a conscious level. I think I'm just sort of drawn to certain things, you know.
That fine film critic, Anthony Lane, said perceptively, I think, and I agree with him, that in all three of your films, your characters are, in his words, driven along paths darker than they foresaw. So there's a sense of fate driving them, if you like, to tragic ends.
Yeah, for sure. Memento mori. I mean, none of us escape, you know. We're all going to perish. This is a common complaint that Serena has about everything I'm drawn to. I guess she says, why does it always have to end like that?
Yes, those are comments I've heard about my music occasionally. I wonder where, in your case, that sense of darkness comes from. Or is it just there in the imagination?
I don't know. You know, I don't know.
Is there a turbulence that perhaps, you know, you once had, which you are able to draw on?
Do you have a prescription pad nearby?
Well,
I mean, I'm open to suggestions, uptake inhibitors, whatever. I don't know. I mean, I guess a lot of the theater and a lot of the films and frankly, a lot of the music like the Skoreshki that I'm drawn to and that seem to activate something in me fall along the lines of what you're describing, I suppose.
Well, let's take a figure who had more drama than she would like in her life because of a terrible medical condition when she was at the height of her powers, from which many of our listeners will know already probably that I'm talking about Jacqueline Dupré, playing the Elgar Cello Concerto. You actually use it in the film, and you say you weren't afraid of anti-populist pretensions. Is it just simply the power of the music that actually overwhelms everything else, as with the Mahler?
I think so. I mean, I think it's really easy to be a snob about populist anything. Just because they're well-known, for a reason. They're incredible music.
Well, this is the famous recording from 1965, which I think you particularly wanted, the one with Barbirolli conducting the LSO.
Indeed, yes. That's the recording that sort of reintroduced this piece to the greater world.
Jacqueline Dupre with the first movement of the Elgar Cello Concerto in E minor, with John Barbirolli conducting the London Symphony Orchestra. And for all the details of the music of my guest today, the film director Todd Field, go to the Private Passions page on the Radio 3 website. On BBC Sounds, of course, you can download hundreds of past programmes. Well, we've been talking, Todd Field, about your career, as if it's a seamless progress from actor to director, from award-winning film to another award-winning film. But in reality, of course, it's not that easy. And you spent some 15 years recently not releasing any films, developing projects that didn't see the light of day. So does that make life in your world quite difficult to live with, or do you just take it as that's the kind of par for the course?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no guarantees for any of us. It's not an art form for the faint-hearted, let's put it that way.
I think you once said that directors need to be stubborn. Do you feel that that's a quality that is pretty essential, to be not ruthless, although jolly nearly, but very stubborn to get something done?
Absolutely. You have to be stubborn. You can't possibly expect other people to die on your sword or to stay up at night thinking about what you're thinking about. If you take on this position, then you must be stubborn. There's no possible reason to want to do it. You don't sleep, you don't eat, you worry constantly, you cajole, you seduce, you beg, you do anything you can to try to get the thing that's inside of you up on that screen. And there's only one benefit, you know, and that's that the thing itself is up there and that you haven't compromised and that you haven't missed something and you haven't been careless, you know. So yes, I think you have to be stubborn.
Well, I remember having written a couple of movie scores that I came to the conclusion that one shouldn't believe it until you see it and hear it on the screen. Would you go along with that?
Absolutely. I'm very superstitious, you know, like I think a lot of people in the arts, and I don't like talking about things until they're way in the rearview mirror. I always have this attendant sort of sense of doom that they won't come off, you know.
Is there an aspect of Tar, and indeed the other films, which perhaps suggests that obsession is a very destructive thing?
Yes, but it's also the engine for everything, you know? I mean, there's no half measures. If you want to make something that keeps you awake at night and does all of those things that we all sort of are these hoary cliches associated with artistry in any discipline, whether you're a painter or a musician or whatever, there's a reason they're cliches. Otherwise, there's really not a lot of upside to doing it.
Cate Blanchett said that making Tar with you was like going into battle every day in a good way.
Well, that last bit was very kind of her.
We're going to play out, Todd, with Stephen Sondheim's Send in the Clowns. It's a very sad song. Missed opportunities, failed connections, someone really completely washed up. That doesn't really fit with you at all, although some of the films have that sense of inevitability about them.
Yes, it's somebody that's facing forward but looking backward at the same time.
Well, let's play out with Sarah Vaughan singing Send in the Clowns. So it only remains for me to say thank you very much, Todd Field.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you very much. I enjoyed coming on the show.
Isn't it rich? Isn't it queer? Losing my time this late.
Send in the Clowns from Stephen Sondheim's A Little Night Music with Sarah Vaughan and the Count Basie Orchestra. And that was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, Todd Field. The episode was produced by Elizabeth Burke and it was a Loftus Media production for BBC Radio 3. And you can find details of all today's music if you search for Private Passions on BBC Sounds. And the programme returns next Sunday at noon when Michael's guest will be the author Diana Melly. You're listening to BBC Radio 3 on 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and on BBC Sounds. It's 1 o'clock and time for the news read by me, Danielle Jaworwiecka. The head of the Royal College of Nursing says there is a chink of optimism in her union's dispute with the government about pay after Rishi Sunak told the BBC's Laura Koonsberg he would be open to a pay deal that is responsible and affordable. Pat Cullen said she'd noticed a little shift in Mr Sunak's stance, but that strike action would still go ahead in 10 days' time because talks planned for tomorrow were not about addressing the core issues of the dispute. Police in Germany have arrested an Iranian man suspected of preparing an Islamist attack using cyanide and the highly toxic poison ricin. He was arrested along with another man during a raid in the city of Kastrop-Rauxel near Dortmund. Local reports suggest police raided a residence wearing protective clothing, having been tipped off by an allied country's intelligence agency. There have been some emotional reunions at airports in China after the country reopened its borders for the first time since the start of the COVID pandemic. International travellers no longer have to quarantine on arrival, and Chinese citizens are once again allowed to go overseas. A man has been charged with murder after human remains were found in a pond in Essex on New Year's Eve. Police say the body of Philip Lewis, who was 59, was likely to have been in the water for weeks. Lee Clark, who's 52, is due to appear before magistrates tomorrow. One of the best-known spies caught by the US has been released from prison after more than 20 years in custody. Ana Montes, who's now 65, spent almost 2 decades spying for Cuba whilst employed as an analyst at the Defence Intelligence Agency. After her arrest in 2001, officials said she'd almost entirely exposed US intelligence operations on the island. One said she was among the most damaging spies caught by the US. People have been queuing to visit the tomb of Pope Benedict XVI at St Peter's Basilica in Vatican City. It opened to the public this morning following his funeral last Thursday. And now a look at the weather. A windy afternoon with showers for western Scotland and Northern Ireland. A band of heavy rain will also push eastwards across England and Wales. Top temperatures of 10 Celsius in London, 8 in Cardiff and 6 in Belfast and Edinburgh. And that's the BBC News and Weather at 1:02.
As a tribute to the late Queen Elizabeth II, English National Opera performs Britain's Gloriana, written for her coronation celebrations. Public duty conflicts with private passion as Christine Rice stars as the ageing Queen Elizabeth I and Robert Murray as her favourite, the Earl of Essex. Gloriana is on Friday evening at 7 on Radio 3. And there's drama about the creation of the opera and the relationship between Britain.